just a baby. Before I could speak, I would line up all my letter blocks alphabetically. Now it's my vocation and my passion to assign every decimal number shelf.
Well, this is a remote location library show, so it's always an experiment, and I hope that I don't make too many faux pas and move this recorder too much, but other than that, I think we'll get the show started. You are listening to The Library Show on KCAW Raven Radio, and I thought what a wonderful thing to do would be to come to our local bookstore.
Yay.
And we have to be understanding that we hope we have lots of customers during the show, and if that's the case, one or the other or both of my guests will have to depart momentarily. But anyway, we're here on the library show, and I should have a stopwatch set, so I better go ahead and do that. And we'll have to just do the best we can to make the show not run over. But at any rate, I'm here at Old Harbor Books with Ashia Lane. Welcome.
Thank you.
And Rachel Klein.
Thanks.
Who I have watched grow into be quite a wonderful employee here.
Yeah. We're so fortunate.
She really knows
Thank
her
you.
Stuff. And so, you know, I was thinking about before the show how, oh, and you may hear chatter in the background,
yes.
But that's just wonderful customers that we are encouraging to make good use of the bookstore. About thinking about some of the things that libraries and bookstores have in common. Can you think of some of the things that we do that you feel are similar?
Books.
Yes.
I think that we help, both places help. Customers or guests or whatever term you like to use, we help get the right book in the right hands. And I think that that's probably the greatest challenge that we all share.
Right. Well, do you have many people come in and kind of ask you for suggestions?
We do. We have quite a few people who want desperately to go home and just sink into a book, but they just don't know where to start because a bookstore, just like a library, there are thousands of titles and it's just very overwhelming
right.
for folks if they're not regularly visiting the shelves. So we have a lot of people who ask for suggestions, what our favorite books have been this year, and questions like that.
Then I guess that my next question was, I know in the library world, the kinds of tools that are used to select books, but how do you make decisions about what you're going to purchase?
We probably use a lot of the same tools. We check the bestseller list, you know, the New York Times and things like that. We have a few different book distributing websites that we can utilize to see what's selling, what's on demand, and we like to look for prize winners, of course. Kind of those things, and then word on the street. We take so many suggestions from customers, and I'll look up the books because, you know, oh, I just read the best book, or oh, I just heard the, you know,
Terry
wonderful,
Gross.
Yes, NPR interview. And so that's how another way I get information, and I'm able to look those things up with the internet and then see what looks like an appropriate fit for our customer base here in Sitka.
Right. And it's interesting because as a library, we may try to keep older things on hand than you are able to. Is that
That's a pretty true statement. We do maintain classic titles, and of course, the collection here is a little shifted towards my choices and the employees' choices, things that were favorites when we were growing up or whatnot. So there are those fun little things, but we also do need to stay focused on current titles and what's popular and what's moving, because at the end of the day, it is a business, and we need to make sure that we're
right.
current.
So. That you're making some money.
Yeah. Keeping the bookstore going is a great challenge these days, you know, with Kindles and everything else and online shopping. It's it's a challenge to keep a brick and mortar store going, and so we try to be current ourselves.
Right. Well, and I just wonder if people in this town who have kind of grown up, so to speak, with Old Harbor Books being here recognize the value of independent bookstores just all over the place. I know I would just be bereft if I couldn't come in. And you see, you know, you learn a lot about a book when you're just able to kind of thumb through it.
Yeah, I think electronic versions of books are fun, and they're very useful for a lot of people. A lot of folks traveling or even just laying in bed don't want to have the weight of a hardcover, but there's nothing like going into the store and getting to hold the book and kind of have that physical bond, if you will, and look at the cover pictures and read the blurbs on the back and the other fun things that come from an actual paper book.
Right. Oh, and I was, Rachel was managed to get back, which is a good thing. Hey. I know that we had a few customers. So that's, we want to keep those customers coming. What do you enjoy about working in a bookstore? I assume you enjoy working here.
Oh, yeah, this was only supposed to be a summer job, and that was about 2.5 years ago, so I really love working here. And it's not just, I think the big thing, obviously, is the staff, because that's who you spend all day with, really, and so it is a lot of fun working here, and she and I have become pretty good friends, which is fun. And, you know, you are always in the loop about interesting books or new books and new authors, and so that's a lot of fun if you're a book lover.
Do you have a few authors who come to mind when you say favorite authors?
Oh, geez.
Sometimes it's just the most recent one I read.
Yeah, yeah. So recently I've been reading a couple of Eric Larson books. I'm not much of a history reader, except I kind of got into a couple of his books this last fall. Those are really good.
What are they about?
So the first one I read is In the Garden of Beasts, which kind of looks at an American family in Berlin in the early 1930s, so right when Hitler was coming into power. And so it was a really good insight into sort of how Hitler got to be where he was at and how he kind of fooled the German people. And it was just such a slow process until all of a sudden it kind of became, you know, and then World War II and the Holocaust. But there was no indication necessarily of that happening in the beginning. And so it kind of has an interesting look into how that.
Right. So it has sort of snowballed.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know if you heard on the radio about the controversy with publishing Mein Kampf.
Mm.
Apparently... I mean, I don't know whether the library still has a copy of it because it was one that was hard to kind of hang on to. I think there's a great curiosity, and Mein Kampf was written by Hitler when he was in prison, in fact. And, I think that it has not been printed in Germany. And apparently there's an annotated version that is being published so that allowing people to read read Hitler's, I guess you call it seminal work, but with annotations sort of explaining and pointing out inaccuracies and things that he said that were not actually in fact. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Sure, a lot of that was also for propaganda to kind of promote his whole regime.
Philosophy.
And, exactly. So.
Now there's another book, see if you could come up with the title, about a young girl who lived in Brittany in Saint-Malo, who was, I think she was blind.
Yeah, All the Light We Cannot See.
All the Light We Cannot See. Have you read that?
I did,
Can you talk a little bit about it?
I actually just read it about a month ago. It was kind of the book I was reading right before Christmas. That's a wonderful book. The writing in it is spectacular. It was kind of a fresh read for me because he is a really interesting writer. The chapters are pretty short, a page or a couple pages each, which is different from what I'm used to reading with fiction. And really, really beautiful descriptive writing, and his characters were really great. It's a beautiful story. It follows a couple of different characters who don't really interact until the very end. but you're following their different storylines throughout the book, and you know that they're going to meet, and you're not really quite sure how or what's going to happen. And there's some intrigue, too, with a very valuable diamond that Hitler is trying to get. It's part of his art collection. And
the main characters are a little girl who is blind.
Yes, she's blind. And so it was really interesting to see how she adapted, because she wasn't always blind her whole life. She became blind when she was 8 or 9, and so she had to change her whole way of living. So it was really interesting to see how her father really helped her with that. And then the other character it follows closely is a German teenager who is like a math and engineering genius, and he gets recruited by the Nazis and to go out into the field and discover where resistance fighters and allied, Russians and I think eventually French troops too are hiding and trying to send secret messages to other citizens and other, members of their cause. So he has a conflict with what he's doing for the German army, but he also wants to be able to, rise above his class and what his life that he was used to. He's an orphan and really poor, and so he just has this internal struggle with,
it's situated in Saint-Malo, which is a small walled city in Brittany, where I've been several times.
Oh, cool.
And what's interesting about it is it was really demolished during World War II. I mean, it was heavily bombed. I think actually when the Germans were going to leave the area, I may not have my history correct, but it has been rebuilt pretty much. And you feel like you're in a very, very old little town. But it sits right on the water and does have a wall around it, and the streets are all cobblestone.
Oh, wow.
And so it's really, very, very attractive little town. So I'm glad you recommended that book, because it's a good one, isn't it? So, Ashia, I want to ask you, what kinds of things are people reading? I know that's a huge question.
It is. I think that we see trends according to what time of year it is. So obviously in the summer, we are seeing a lot of Alaska-themed books go out of the store. In the spring, I feel like, and also during Whale Fest in the fall, we have a lot of nautical-themed books that are popular. And then that, just looking around, sorry, I got sidetracked.
That's okay.
We see a lot of books moving when a movie of the book is about to come out or is out. So right now, we've probably sold a dozen copies of The Revenant, which was here last week.
Yeah, it's funny. I don't know if we sold a copy when it was out in hardcover.
Probably not. Maybe one.
It's very popular.
Yeah, and so we've got The Fifth Wave is a teen book that's a movie this week. We had In the Heart of the Sea
was really big
last month, I think.
Now, what was that about? I don't know if I know that.
That is the tragedy of the whale ship Essex. It's a Nathaniel Philbrick book, and
that's been out for a while.
Yeah, it's been out for years. And they made this, big budget Hollywood movie, which was very fun.
God bless him.
Chris Hemsworth.
I haven't read the book, and folks who have told me that the stories differ quite a bit, but it was still a fun movie. And so we've sold quite a few copies of that. And so that tends to be a trend here. We also sell a lot of books from our local book clubs here.
Yes.
So there's the women's book group, for instance, and they usually pick about 9 titles every year. And we have those available for everyone to buy, of course. And I like to read.
To read some of those, too.
Yeah, and so a couple this year just knocked my socks off. They're great choices. And
well,
so
coincidentally, I just interviewed Dorothy Orbison, who helps organize that.
She does, yeah. She she supplies us with the list and gets everybody motivated to get out and buy their books every month. And,
right.
And they're available all year round. But one of my favorites this year was Station 11, which the ladies read in November.
A lot of people are talking about that. Of course, I think it's such an... And I don't want you to spoil it for me because I've only just started it.
Okay.
I have some ideas about it that I think are going to be, in fact, the case. Because Dorothy did confirm for me one or two things. And yes. I said, don't spoil it for me because...
It's very elegant writing, yes. And it's a surprising story. We actually keep it here in the store. We keep it over in our sci-fi fantasy section because of the time period it's set in,
right.
Which it's a little post-apocalyptic.
Right.
But that's not what the story is about at all. It's about following these characters and figuring out how they're going to navigate the world as they find it. And right. That's all I'll say. But it was great.
Yeah, it is interesting when you have those things that sort of are post-apocalyptic. I think of Anne Atwood and The Handmaid's Tale,
Margaret
which was
Atwood.
Margaret
yeah.
Atwood.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
And then
I just read that.
Yeah.
I'm exploring sci-fi, fantasy,
or even
all of these.
Cormac
things.
McCarthy's The Road. That one's really heavy, but that's also post-apocalyptic.
Right. Right. Yeah. And not highly. Not real techie. It's not reliant on
yeah.
a lot of technology. I
yeah.
suppose the assumption being that most of the technology will be gone if they were in a post-apocalyptic
yeah,
world.
Yeah, they have less technology
yeah.
than
right.
in those stories than we do
right.
now.
Well, actually, have you ever read Neville Shute's On the Beach?
No.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of one of those that goes back a while, mm-hmm. but what that explored was... And I don't know if it was written around Cuban Missile Crisis time when there was a sense that perhaps, you know, the United States would, you know, be bombed or that there would be some kind of an atomic war in the northwestern hemisphere. And so what happens is it takes place in, I believe it's Australia, and they know that this cloud of radiation is coming towards them. It's inevitable. Nothing's going to stop it. But it's not there yet. So what do you do with your life if you know that you won't see another winter or spring? Mm-hmm. And so it follows these characters and how differently they respond to what they know is their end.
Wow.
You know, some mm-hmm. become sort of very hedonistic. Some choose to ignore it. You know, they plant the tulips anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, how a parent who has a young child responds in that situation. So that's sort of post-apocalyptic and was written some time ago and absolutely had no technology in it
yeah.
other than exploding bombs.
Yeah.
So, and I was just curious, and I maybe it's a false division, but the difference between sort of literary fiction and popular, very popular nonfiction, the kind of thing that you might, well, I don't know, I won't characterize it, but you know what I'm saying?
Popular fiction.
Versus
yeah.
sort of what,
yeah.
literary fiction?
It's a real
There's
thing.
A difference.
The
popular fiction authors tend to be, they produce a lot of books.
A lot of books.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I have my suspicions.
Yeah, I think there's definitely room for both, and we have plenty mm-hmm. of both here. We try not to lean too heavily on one way or the other. I think popular fiction tends to be like your Daniel Roberts or even Stephen King, kind
mm-hmm.
of the books that tend to end up in the mass market size. You know, something you might be able to also grab at a grocery store
right.
or something. They're so exciting.
They're really know? Great for when you don't want to really think a whole lot about what you're reading. Like you want to go to the beach and have
fast
a fun,
paced.
fast-paced read.
Right.
Yeah,
that it is enjoyable, but there isn't a whole lot of you know. You don't have to break down the sentences
right.
or really.
Right.
And then, the literary is just a little, it tends to be a little more challenging. That
mm-hmm.
would probably be the main breakdown that I have for differences
right.
between the two. But like I said, there's definitely room for both. There's an audience for both.
And we read, you know.
Right. Do you have any favorite mass market writers that come to mind?
You know, what's been so popular are the Game of Thrones books.
Right.
They've just been flying out of here, coinciding with the TV show. The Outlander series is very fun. Stephen King, if you can sleep at night.
I like some Stephen King.
It's a little creepy.
Yeah. I was trying to tell someone that I don't watch scary shows. Mm-hmm. And I'm the kind of person who runs out of the room and then says, tell me what's happening. And I haven't been able to read too many horror fiction novels.
Well, one that she and I both have been really kind of into or enjoying is Jennifer. Is it McMahon? Is that how you?
McMahon?
Maybe? McMahon.
So we can't pronounce it.
We can't pronounce
it,
her last name.
Oh my gosh.
But she has written some scary
good horror.
But really good. We couldn't put it down.
Yeah, and she, I would say, the first one I read was The Night Sister.
And I read Winter People first.
Winter People. Yeah. But she actually kind of walks the line between the literary and the popular.
Yeah, she's kind of a hybrid. She has some really interesting reoccurring themes in her multiple books. There's a lot of child loss. And a lot of female leads.
There's always a creepy little girl.
Yep. In a tiny Vermont town that has a lot of history.
And there's woods everywhere.
Yeah,
of course.
But they are really creepy. There are times where I usually don't get too scared. Movies don't really, even
right.
scary movies or scary books don't really tend to freak me out. But when I was reading her books,
you don't want to be alone.
The hair on my neck, or on my arms would stand up, and that never happens to me. So if anyone likes, horror,
it's
getting
good
scared,
to know.
Check out her
so
books.
McMahon or something like that.
Jennifer.
She wrote The Night Sister, Winter People. She has probably 5 or 6 books.
They're really fun.
That were very fun. Yeah. We've actually been reading a lot of thrillers, the staff.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. We got Tina works here also.
Right. Right.
And so I read, I think it was actually about a year and a half ago, I first read a book that came into my hands, an advanced reader copy called Descent. And I kept raving about this book. I said, it's just really well paced and it's a murder mystery thriller. Mm-hmm. And this is completely outside of what I normally read. But you guys have to read it. And so Rachel and Tina both just finished it and enjoyed that.
And I cruised through that one on my trip in Hawaii because it was another fast-paced, really fun read and kind of creepy, but not in like a ghost or, that kind of demon scent. No, not paranormal, but just actual real humans just being creepy.
Humans.
Yeah.
We read lots of things. Yeah. All the genres are covered here between all of us.
Yeah.
So when you mentioned it a little bit out of the, your normal customary reading habits. So what kinds of things do you... I mean, I know you have to look at a lot.
I just don't know what my normal is anymore. I working here has afforded me a lot of time to contemplate what looks like a good book.
Right.
And so I pick a lot of poetry collections.
So who are some of your favorite poets? Because I brought along Billy Collins. I'm not a big poetry reader. Some of it I just find I cannot comprehend. But Billy Collins is often funny.
Yeah.
And there was one that I was just looking at about being 10. Uh-huh. And he was just bemoaning the fact that he was turning 10.
Oh.
And it reminded me of my sister when she was going to become a teenager. Mm-hmm. She was, leaving her youth behind her, she felt. And I guess she was moping around the house, and my mother said, "Well, Martha, what's wrong?" And she said, "I don't want to be a teenager." She was happy where she was. So I saw that poem by him, and I thought, oh, I can understand that.
Yeah, I don't know that I have any favorites. I will read practically any poet, at least 5 poems, to just kind of get a feel. I like a lot of contemporary poetry, where I think must have probably, well, actually, we have a lot now. When I started, we had a lot of the classics, and now I think we have a good mix. So there's some surprising books in our poetry section. I read memoirs once in a while, and I complain about them like no one else. gosh, just everybody has the saddest story, and
I always like the cooking memoirs. Those are fun.
Those ones are probably more fun than the ones that
I haven't really tried any others.
Did you read the one by the guy who wrote, I think it was called something like 52 Loaves, and he baked a loaf of bread every week because he'd had some bread in France that was just perfect, you know, the nice crusty crust and some good size air holes. So he decides that he's going to try to recreate that. But then he kind of, one chapter he discusses a lot about yeast. Mm-hmm. And then he talks about he grew some of his own wheat and ground the wheat. But he knew that the monasteries in France had a great reputation at one time for baking their bread. And so he contacts a monastery, and it was a very sparsely populated group of older men, and they invited him back to teach them what he knew because they had
really
given up. So it may not be 52 loaves of bread, but if you want to read a good cooking
and
memoir,
I love bread, so that sounds right up my alley, because maybe I'll get some recipe ideas to try at home.
That would be good.
Yeah.
So speaking of nonfiction, you know, in a small independent bookstore, how do you buy? I mean, are there more? I can tell you one section in the library that's very popular. It's the 641.5, which is cooking.
Well, cookbooks, you can, very often I fall back on judging the book by the cover.
Especially for cookbooks.
We have to shop through catalogs very often, which makes it hard. There's not a lot of information typically with the titles, and so there's some blind shopping, but I think, you know, again, checking in with people, real people, and what they're reading and what they're hearing about is the best way, and then checking the lists and checking what's popular and listening to the publishing houses also, because they push books, of course, but oftentimes they're pushing their best books.
Right.
So that doesn't mean we buy every single one, but we do listen.
Well, and they're pushing in them, I was going to say, I mean, they're trying to persuade you to buy them, but the public is also hearing about them, you know, I like a good publisher. I don't have anything really against self-published books, but I know that when there's a publisher involved, they've got editors.
Yeah.
And some real support from people who really have some intelligence when it comes to writing. And
I think that's important. We do not typically have self-published books in the store because, you know, they don't have the team promotion and whatnot. And also because it's a little less reliable, I think. I try to use, you know, catalogs, word of mouth, interviews on NPR.
Yeah, I was going to say we look at the NPR reviews are Goodreads. Those reviews on there
is a good
really helpful
source also. Mm-hmm. And it's not the most professional source, but it works.
But you get a general idea of like, oh, this book maybe actually not, it might not be that good. So
right. Well, and I think you know that there's a pretty good listenership for NPR and some of those things. And I used to look at the bestseller lists some, and I always try to have at least one off of there. I mean, you know, one copy of most of that. But even that wasn't always reliable.
Yeah.
You know, you do your best to get what you need. Well, I'm seeing that we have just about exhausted our time, so I'm going to let listeners know that they have been listening to Ishia Lane and Rachel Klein at Old Harbor Books, just talking about books because I think there's nothing better.
Thanks
there is
for
nothing
coming
better.
All right. Well, thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.